This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour today. Our panel of trumpet writers is ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
One of the Bible's most important end time prophecies is the rise of a unified European empire to become the dominant power in the world for a short time. Herbert W. Armstrong spoke about this for decades, long before the European Union formed, long before those nations created a single European currency, long before the political structures of the European Commission and the European Parliament were in place. And one thing he said over and again was that this European empire wouldn't be just an economic union, not just a political union, but also that it would become a single unified military power. And within the lumbering bureaucratic machinery currently running the European Union, this has been a mighty difficult task. We've been reporting for years about how this has been their intent, but actual moves to build this unified military have been few and they've been slow coming. This week, though, they reached an agreement that pundits are saying marks the biggest step forward in EU defense policy in decades. So for this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
That's right. And the EU leaders themselves spoke very highly of this moment. Federica Mogherini called the signing ceremony for this new military union and called it an emotional moment. There were, I think she may have even had some tears while they were signing and presenting that. Similarly, other leaders called it a milestone in European development. And like you said, this is something that European leaders have been working towards and not managing for a long time. What they specifically put in place here is something called permanent structured cooperation, or the acronym PESCO. And this was something that was kind of foreseen in the Lisbon Treaty, the EU constitution from years ago. They couldn't get enough people to agree to it back then, so they set up in the EU constitution, well, if at any point we can get a group of nations that want to integrate more militarily, we'll set up a way for them to do it. And so now they're finally able to do that. Now, because military union and all military matters, this is the most fundamental building block of national sovereignty, controlling your nation's defense. And so because of that, they always knew it would be really hard to get all 27 or 28, as it is right now, EU nations on board. And this PESCO agreement allowed a smaller number to move forward. So that's what happened on this. Just 23 nations agreed to sign up. Some of the others have said they may join. Some of the ones that have signed up said they may drop out. But it's 23 right now, and they basically agreed to start thinking about their defense much more as one block rather than 23 little blocks. And this is quite a big deal. I saw one survey saying that, or one study that concluded that the EU has 50% of America's military spending, but 15% of America's military capability. Because so much of this is duplicated and spread out between different countries, duplicated effort, etc. This PESCO agreement comes a long way to eliminating that. So they're going to, when they look at defense priorities, they're not going to look at individual strengths and weaknesses so much anymore, but focus on overall strengths and weaknesses. And so if the EU has an overall weakness, then one particular military can work on being really strong in that area and then rely on their neighbors to cover any resulting weaknesses or imbalances that allows. So you're looking at something that's, you can see why this took a long time to put together, because say a few years down the line, it's not going to be very easy for any nation to back out of this. If you say have focused on tanks and Europe's ground force at the expense of having almost no air force, and you're depending on other eight nations to cover your air force, and that's not going to be something you can quit in a hurry. And so that's the kind of direction that we're moving in.
This is really, it is extraordinary to look at Europeans' capability. If you combine all of these countries' military might together, we actually put that together in the infographic for our November-December trumpet issue, which is up online right now. It's called Combined Might. A lot of people looking at the United States as just this preponderantly powerful military. But when you hold it up against what all of these countries in Europe are able to combine to produce, the disparity is much, much smaller than it looks otherwise.
That's right. And this is just going to make them be able to have a much more effective military status overall. I think it's also going to have a big impact on just on their future of defense spending. I mean, one of the big differences or weaknesses of the EU compared to the US is, you know, the US just has a few major types of tanks. The EU has dozens. The same with planes, with all these other different weapon systems. Now, most of the EU is all NATO, so they still use the same standards for ammunition and, you know, gauges for trucks and this kind of thing. But it's still very fragmented. But this is going, one of the biggest focuses of this PESCO agreement is for future weapons development and just trying to get as many nations all on board working with the same, working on the same projects rather than all this duplicated effort. I think the other thing, the important thing that comes out of this PESCO agreement, though, that is kind of easy to overlook, is it really piles on the pressure for Europe to spend more. And we've talked about this as well. You pointed out how much they already spend compared to the US. There's that NATO target of 2%. Well, this PESCO, they haven't released their target yet, but there will be a target level of spending, and it will be mandatory. If nations do not increase their spending regularly in order to meet this target, they will be kicked out of this PESCO agreement, which that is something that is going to carry some real teeth because, like we've said just now, 5 years down the line, that's not something you can easily get kicked out of. It will really hurt you if you do. There will probably be different funds and monetary incentives to stay in there as well. So nations won't want to quit. But this will put on real pressure to nations to keep upping their military budget. And we've talked about, well, France already spends more than Russia. Germany, if it spends 2% of its economy, that's its NATO target, that makes it a really big deal. That way outspends Russia. You'll have several of these major military powers in Europe. And so I think that's the other big deal, or one other big deal of this PESCO. It's not just working together, but it's a lot of pressure for Europe to do more militarily, spend more militarily. And then you put this in context with some of the other initiatives going on right now. Federica Mogherini in October was talking about deploying EU battlegroups to North Africa. That's something that's actively being considered. If that happens, that will be the first time ever that these European battlegroups have ever been deployed. So this is really a transformational moment right now, and it has been for the last year or so for European military. There's a whole load of different aspects just all coming together. PESCO is a major part of that, but it's still just a part of that overall trend.
Awesome to watch this happening. And we've been talking about this, expecting this development for decades. Richard has an article on thetrumpet.com called EU Leaders Take Historic Step Toward United Military. We also have a trends article that is linked to within that article, why the Trumpet watches Europe's push toward a unified military. That gives the large context of this, and it even goes back to what Herbert W. Armstrong was saying for decades, expecting exactly this to happen based on the prophecies of the Bible. Now we're seeing it happen, and they're taking real steps toward making this a reality. So it really is a vindication of those prophecies that we've talked about for decades. We appreciate that, Richard. We'll move now to the Middle East. Tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran really heated up last week, and they've gotten even hotter this week. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this standoff between Saudi Arabia and Iran really has continued this coming week this past week, a number of new developments that I'd just like to go through so that people understand that this isn't going away. While Saudi Arabia and Iran have been enemies for a long time, Saudi Arabia is really digging its heels in right now over Lebanon. Lebanon's the main factor right now. Of course, Iran has done a lot of destabilizing actions and has hit Saudi Arabia many places where their interests are at stake. But Lebanon's the area we're talking about mainly right now. And just this past week, we did have on Thursday, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia give a press conference alongside the French foreign minister in Riyadh, in the capital of Saudi Arabia. And he basically took a lot out on Hezbollah, the Shiite terrorist group that basically holds the Lebanese government to ransom. They are, of course, funded, equipped, directed from Iran. They don't deny that. He said this: Hezbollah is a tool of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and that it has kidnapped the Lebanese. Any way you look at it, they, the Iranians, are the ones who are acting in an aggressive manner. We are reacting to that aggression and saying enough is enough. And then he said that consultations and coordination between peace-loving countries and Lebanon-loving countries are underway to try and find a way that would restore sovereignty to Lebanon and reduce the negative actions which Hezbollah is conducting in Lebanon. So that's quite a threat, basically right. Saying we're negotiating with other people around the world right now how to rid Hezbollah from Iran, Hezbollah from Lebanon, Iran's influence from Lebanon. So they are drawing a line in the sand here.
A very, very strong statement. And when we were talking about this last week, we were just speculating. There were people who were saying, well, in a way, Saudi Arabia is withdrawing its presence there. That this kind of leaves, it was basically just trying to expose how entrenched Iran was there. We're looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, that we know Lebanon is going to break away from Iranian influence, and it seems like this definitely looks like the leverage that Saudi Arabia needs to make that happen.
Yeah, that you're exactly right. A lot of people are saying this is it for Saudi Arabia's influence in Lebanon. They're pulling out just to expose what Iran's doing so everyone else can see it. But that's not the case. They are invested. The French are invested as well. We've talked about that. This him saying this was right next to the French foreign minister. Mm-hmm. And the French foreign minister, after the Saudi foreign minister said that, he said that they are concerned about Iran's intervention in regional crises and its hegemonic intentions in the region. Mm-hmm. The French are right alongside the Saudis, right, saying that, yeah, we're with the Saudis on this. And so the Saudis actually have quite a lot of leverage inside Lebanon against Hezbollah's actions. Yes, Hezbollah has the fighters on the ground. They're the strongest military. They're stronger than the Lebanese armed forces. As far as the economic power and might that Saudi Arabia has to inflict a lot of harm on Lebanon until the people get the message, they can do quite a lot. Right now, the Lebanese economy is not very strong at all. It's one of the weakest economies in the world. It's dangerous. It's in completely a dangerous situation right now, and it's basically can be propped up by the Saudis. There's about 400,000 Lebanese that are currently working in GCC states in the Gulf that Saudi Arabia could say, sorry, get out of our country. They provide 10% of the GDP of Lebanon, sending their money back to Lebanon, which could totally destabilize the country further. Saudi Arabia could decide to take out their deposits, their foreign reserves inside Lebanon, which could really shake the Lebanese financial system. They've already said no to a lot of the GCC states for their nationals visiting, so that their tourism's taking a huge hit right now as well.
As strong as Saudi Arabia's position is relative to Lebanon, what I think just makes this all the more compelling is France's role in this. It would be one thing if Saudi Arabia were making these statements on their own, but the fact that it's next to the French foreign minister, the fact that now Saad Hariri is going to Paris, and that the French president he's inserted himself into this situation. You've got the Iranian foreign minister saying, well, France has hegemonic intentions in the Middle East, looking at just how involved it's getting in this situation. You really see this relationship between Saudi Arabia and France developing in a way that is shocking, or it's tremendous in terms of its fulfillment of the prophecies that we've been watching.
Right. So as you said, I mean, it looked like Saad Hariri would go back to Lebanon from Saudi Arabia. He hasn't. People remember that he resigned from Saudi Arabia, the former prime minister. And it looked like he was going to go back to Lebanon and hand in his formal resignation there. Well, in the meantime, he's decided to answer the call, as you said, of the French president and Macron, and he's visiting tomorrow on Saturday. The French president. What are they going to discuss? Well, they're going to discuss more of what they can do to find ways, like the Saudis, to rid Iran's influence from Lebanon. This is huge, and it does run counter in many ways to what you hear from the establishment Europeans in the foreign policy arena, especially what Federica Mogherini is saying. She's basically the foreign minister for the 28 nation group, and she's going around kind of dismissing what the French are doing. And yet the French, because of her relationship with Iran, I think, but the French are really voting. Well, they're really moving with their feet here, inserting themselves into the situation. And that's exactly what Bible prophecy says will happen, that you're going to have an alliance with Saudi Arabia, with Lebanon, and other Middle Eastern countries, and the Europeans. They're going to come together, and that's actually going to be, looks like, caused by Iran's rise. Because of their mutual interest, it's stopping Iran's rise. Are we seeing that right now? We look like, it really does look like we are starting to see the fulfillment of that prophecy.
We have a Trends article that is called Germany Allying with Arab Nations. And it's obviously it's speaking of a European power more generally. It's not France specifically, but this really is a major trend that we've had our eyes on for a long time that you definitely see playing itself out, or at least moving in that direction in a pretty powerful way. And as you mentioned, this fissure between Lebanon and Iran that we've been watching for a long time, we really could see this hastening that division as we've been expecting for decades. So definitely an important prophecy to watch. You can go to thetrumpet.com and get the link to that Trends article, and we'll put that in the show notes for this program as well. Thanks for that, Brent. Before we move on from this story, we're going to take a quick look at a related story, a closely related story. Arms sales from Germany to Saudi Arabia increased significantly. For this, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
That's right. German arms exports to Egypt and Saudi Arabia quintupled in the third quarter of 2017 compared to the same quarter in 2016. So for Egypt, that was about 300 million euros worth of arms purchases in just that 3 months. And then for Saudi Arabia, it was 150 million euros. Now, for Saudi Arabia, it seems that that's very likely to be for 4 patrol boats and 110 military trucks. That deal was announced by the government back in July. So we're probably just seeing that go through. The Egypt deal, we don't know what that's for yet, which I think in some ways makes it very interesting. I think, you know, there's the same thinking behind both here. Germany is looking for allies, looking to prop up nations that are opposed to Iran. Saudi Arabia is one of the main leaders of that, and Egypt is kind of a shaky member of that group right now. Mm-hmm. They're having a lot of financial difficulties. America has been less and less willing to give them the same kind of generous assistance that they were giving before. And so Germany seems like they're trying to reach out to Egypt and kind of prop them up, stop them from falling apart or falling into the Iranian camp.
Yeah, it's so interesting to look at a story like this. And if you look at Germany trying to strengthen its relationships and create these military ties with Saudi Arabia and with Egypt, just looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, we know the outcome is very different for those two countries. We were just talking about how much this relationship between a European power and Saudi Arabia and this other group of, say, more moderate Muslim countries is one that is going to get some traction and really change the course of events. The one with Egypt, we expect Egypt to go more into the camp of the Iranians at some point. And so this military hardware that Germany would be sending down there would go in the other direction. But this definitely does show just how involved, like the Iranian foreign minister was saying, well, it really looks like France has some hegemonic ambitions in the Middle East. And you'd have to say, looking at stories like this one, that there is that evidence that Europe does have a very strong vested interest in what's happening in the Middle East, and particularly there is evidence that it's taking sides in this this battle that's going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Oh, absolutely. This is more probably a longer term indication. Like I said, that the Saudi deal is probably a reflection of something that was announced back in July and that would have been negotiated in the months before then, rather than a response to the immediate crisis. Mm-hmm. But it really does seem what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now, you know, could be pivotal in terms of some of these prophecies that we're watching, especially, you know, one of the key forecasts that we've made and Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has made based on Bible prophecy that Brent was talking about was about Lebanon switching sides, going to Europe, and the fact that Lebanon's closely involved in what's happening.
Yeah.
Maybe this will be part of the moment that happens. And you see Saudi Arabia, they had some big deals with China over the summer and were looking at selling lots of oil with China. You know, they're obviously unsure of their reliance on the United States and they're looking around for new partners. So it'd be interesting to see now if Germany changes in response to some of the more recent events. We've seen France's response, but are these type of arms deals only going to accelerate now?
Absolutely right. And you can find out more about that. Again, just look at that trends article, Germany allies with Arab nations, for more prophetic context to this story. We appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. It's not every week that you have a military coup, but we did have one this week. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, the world's longest ruling dictator is now under house arrest in Zimbabwe. President Robert Mugabe, after 37 years in power, has been put under house arrest as general staff of that nation has taken control of state media broadcasting and deployed armed vehicles into the streets of the capital. Zimbabweans found out about this early Wednesday morning when they turned on their those, I guess, fortunate enough to have televisions, turned on their television, and the their local normal news anchor has been replaced with a general in camouflage, reassuring everyone that there totally wasn't a coup last night, which is kind of one of the subtle signs for coup watchers to pick right. up on the fact that something unusual may have happened.
Yeah.
But this is something that has been building for a while in Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe is 93, not going to live forever. His wife, who's been positioning herself to take over from him, but she's quite unpopular, especially with the military and even with certain segments of the people, as kind of like a Marie Antoinette type figure who's most famous for buying expensive handbags in Hong Kong and not actually running the country. Mm-hmm. So she still was able to get her husband's ear, though, to the point where he dismissed the vice president on November 6th, the vice president being Emmerson Mnangagwa.
The crocodile.
Emmerson the crocodile, who was a big supporter of Mugabe back during the revolution against Ian Smith's Rhodesia in the 60s. And so been with him a long time, but she convinced her husband to fire him, and reports are that he fled to China immediately after. The chief general, General Constantino, followed him to China right after that and met with the People's Liberation Army, came back to Zimbabwe, and on Monday announced that he wasn't going to let Grace Mugabe keep purging military loyalists from the party. the ruling party in Zimbabwe turned around and accused him of treason. And then the next day he turned back around and put the Mugabe under house arrest and took over the city.
So these guys are saying that, well, they're just doing this to protect the president, that if we, once we kind of get rid of the danger around him, then we'll be back to the status quo. But we can't really take those statements at face value.
Yeah, that's kind of true, kind of not. I mean, the way the generals see it is, like I said, we were the guys who were fighting with Mugabe in the revolution back in the 60s. We are the regime. Now they have this new wife who's 40 years younger than him, who came in and is trying to take over the country after he dies. I think they use the phrase "power is not sexually transmitted" at one point. So because we're the people who fought for this, and so we want to keep the regime in the hands of the revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. They said the president's obviously said we don't have anything against President Mugabe, but we just want to make sure that his wife isn't able to stack the deck to install herself as a successor after he's gone. After he's gone, we want, like I said, one of us to. And it looks like it is the Emerson the Crocodile, who their military is looking to install as like the head of an interim government until elections can be held.
But there is another power at play here.
Right. The military is kind of the big player. But as I mentioned, that the even back during the revolution, the Zimbabwe revolutionaries were sending troops to China for training. This vice president fled to China right after this, and then the general went to China right after that. And a few people have raised an eyebrow at the fact that the general was meeting with the Chinese People Liberation Army like 3 days before this coup took place. China's come out and said, like, oh, no, this was definitely a standard meeting, although they have quotes that the Chinese government definitely did give the general quite a few assurances that China and Zimbabwe are all-weather friends, not fair-weather friends, but all-weather friends. So it seems likely that if you're going to stage a coup, you'd okay it with your country's biggest investor first. Mm. And from China's standpoint, as much as they liked working with the Mugabe regime, he is 93, and I'm sure they don't want to risk any civil instability between Grace Mugabe's faction and the military faction. So it seems like they've realized that the military is the one with the power. Let's back them and make sure that our investments are safe as a new general kind of moves into the position that Robert Mugabe's filled for the last 37 years.
So Andrew has an article up on thetrumpet.com called "Who's Behind the Coup in Zimbabwe?" and explores this angle of China's involvement in this whole scenario and why it is an interesting angle to the story just when looked at from Bible prophecy. There's a bit of information in there about what the Bible says about China's involvement in Africa and Zimbabwe in particular. So go check that out. Who is behind the coup in Zimbabwe? And you can get that that prophetic context to what's happening here. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. An interesting development in Asia and the advancement of this Kings of the East alliance we're watching for. Russia aiming to make a peace treaty with Japan at the cost of driving a wedge in Japan's alliance with America. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
This week, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about how Russia and Japan have never formally concluded a peace treaty after World War II ended. And he talked about how their relations have suffered quite a lot because of that. And he signaled that before Moscow and Japan can finally conclude a peace treaty, which they would both like to do, Tokyo might first have to reconsider its longstanding defense alliance with the United States. Mr. Putin said, quote, "There are lots of questions regarding the peace treaty, and it's not a secret that we also need to look at what commitments Japan has towards its partners in the areas of defense and security and how that will influence the progress of the negotiating process on the peace treaty between Russia and Japan." So Mr. Putin didn't specifically name any country, but the United States is clearly the nation whose defense partnership with Japan troubles him. after Japan wreaked some of the worst brutality in history and then surrendered in World War II, the Allied powers were eager to prevent a repetition of all of that mayhem. And so first came Article 9. That was the clause that America wrote into Japan's post-war constitution, and that bans Tokyo from building a military any larger than what it needs for the self-defense of its immediate geography. And then after that came the Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security. That's a pact between the U.S. and Japan, which, well, among other things, it codified Japan's dependence on the United States for its defense. And as part of this pact, the United States has long maintained a really sizable military presence in Japan, including about 40,000 U.S. military personnel that are stationed there right now. And the Russians just detest this U.S. presence so close to their borders. Moscow routinely accuses America of projecting military power very near to Russian territory, and they say that these U.S. bases in Japan are a huge part of that problem. So to me, it's very interesting that President Putin would bring up the fact that Japan and Russia have failed to sign a peace pact, and then almost in the same breath say America's military cooperation with Japan is basically the main obstacle to that peace treaty. And one thing that we don't hear about very often is how just about a week or two after the two atomic bombs were dropped on Japan, and then after Japan had accepted the Potsdam Declaration and surrendered, after all of that had happened, the Soviet Union occupied and annexed four Japanese islands. Just about a week afterward. And these are four islands that lie to the north of the Japanese mainland and to the east of Russia. They're known in Russia as the Southern Kurils and in Japan as the Northern Territories. And Japan insists that these resource-rich islands are rightfully and inherently Japanese. And it's really the dispute over these islands that has prevented Russia and Japan from ever formally signing a peace treaty to conclude World War II. And both sides have said repeatedly that they cannot compromise on this issue. But both Moscow and Tokyo really want to be able to normalize their relations and be closer partners. So the fact that Putin would mention the need for a peace treaty and then say Japan's alliance with America is a problem has been viewed by some analysts as a signal that Putin could be willing to use the Kuril Islands as kind of a bargaining chip, and that he may be willing to return some or all of them to Japan in exchange for Japan working to diminish or end the U.S.-Japan alliance. And many among the leadership in Japan, including the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, have been working for years to normalize Japan's military and to kind of unshackle it from its dependence on America. So an offer by Moscow to return some or all of these disputed islands in exchange for Japan ousting those American forces would really give these leaders just one more in a long list of reasons to hasten Japan's return to full militarism and to speed up Tokyo's break from Washington. And this is fascinating because back in 1971, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, who was the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet's Forerunner magazine, he forecast that Japan would soon return to full militarism and that Japan would most likely end up allying with Russia. There's one quote from the 1971 Plain Truth that says, "Japan today has no military establishment, but we should not lose sight of the fact that Japan has become so powerful economically that it could build a military force of very great power very rapidly." And then for decades, this forecast by Mr. Armstrong probably would have seemed pretty alarmist to a lot of geopolitical onlookers. But now, as the threat posed to Japan by North Korea and by China intensifies, as nationalist leaders in Japan quietly work to dismantle the pacifist architecture in the country, as America's security assurances become less and less reliable, and as Russia is working to bring Japan in as a closer partner, Mr. Armstrong's forecasts no longer appear far-fetched at all. And Mr. Armstrong's analysis was accurate because it was based on specific Bible prophecies, such as Revelation 16:12, which say that a powerful Asian bloc called the Kings of the East will come together in the end time and pool their militaries together. And then there's a passage in Ezekiel 38, which is about this Asian military bloc, and it shows that both Russia and Japan will be a part of this Kings of the East power bloc. So if Russia were to offer Japan these territories in exchange for diminishing or ending that U.S.-Japan alliance, it would represent a major step forward in the fulfillment of these Bible prophecies and the coming together of the Kings of the East power bloc there. So if there are any listeners who would like to better understand the details of the role that this Kings of the East power bloc will play in end-time Bible prophecies and the specific scriptures that Mr. Armstrong studied in order to make his predictions, I would encourage them to go to thetrumpet.com and order a free copy of our booklet, He Was Right. There's a whole chapter in there about Japan and about what Mr. Armstrong said about it and about how you can see that happening now and see that his forecasts were accurate.
And I would just add to that, Jeremiah has an article on thetrumpet.com called Will Russia Push Japan to End Its Defense Treaty with the U.S.? That also gives the prophetic context to what he's describing here and links to that He Was Right chapter and other resources. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about something that Israel and Saudi Arabia agree on, Australia voting yes to same-sex marriage, and much more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
All right, we're going to go back now to the Saudi Arabia-Iran situation, with Saudi Arabia making such strong moves against Iran these days. The Jewish state of Israel is watching this from the sidelines, and it feels like it has something to really cheer about here. It has long considered Iran the greatest threat in the region, so it feels like this is a real point of agreement with the Saudis. This week, Israel's military chief came out and said as much in an interview with a Saudi paper. Really interesting statements, and especially when you look at this and you understand Bible prophecy. For this, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this was the first time any senior Israeli Defense Force officer had been interviewed by a Saudi paper. Previously, you would, with relations between the Saudis and Israel not being strong, or being very antagonistic, you wouldn't want to publish this if you're a Saudi paper. But they realize right now that there is a reason to have a closer relationship with Israel, because Israel is one of the most powerful militaries in the region, and they have this mutual interest at stopping Iran's rise. And so you had this interviewer talking to the chief of staff from Israel, some powerful quotes in there. I'll just read a couple of them. The military chief called Iran the real and largest threat to the region. He said that Israel and Saudi Arabia are in complete agreement about Iran's intentions. He also noted that Saudi Arabia and Israel had never fought each other, so we don't have a history here of warfare between our nations. And then he basically said further on, just like to quote something that's pretty important, he said that we are willing to exchange information with moderate Arab countries, including intelligence information, in order to deal with Iran. So that is basically saying we are ready to come into a strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia or others in the region that want to counter Iran, and we will share with you the information, intelligence on Iran's movements so that we can together combat this threat.
What do you make of this in light of Bible prophecy, Brent?
Well, it is interesting, and it, because Israel is positioned right now, it's got – as far as if you're going to impact the situation in Lebanon and Hezbollah's on the northern border of Israel, it seems that in some type of Israeli alliance, Saudi Arabia would need that if there was ever going to be some military action against Hezbollah.
Right. If you're just looking at it from a strategic standpoint, it makes sense. It makes sense. Looking at what Saudi Arabia is doing, you know, you can't look at what the Israeli military chief is saying here and say, that this is a bad move, but.
Right, exactly. But is it a bad move for Israel? That's how we look at this, because biblical prophecy does indicate in Psalm chapter 83, a prophecy we've talked about a lot. It talks about this in Psalm 83. It talks about this alliance between Arab states and Germany and Europe, as we talked about in the first segment. But specifically in there, it talks about this alliance targeting Israel. It doesn't talk about it targeting Iran. Mm-hmm. If you were going to guess who is going to attack Israel, the Saudi alliance or the Iranian alliance, you definitely say the Iranians, they've done it so much. But the Bible indicates that it's actually going to be an alliance that includes Saudi Arabia. And I'd just like to quote from this chapter.
Well, that's not to say that the Iranian alliance doesn't pose a threat or that they're not going to cause damage. And it doesn't even necessarily talk about the Saudi part of that. But it does expose their intent.
It definitely does. And of course, yeah, I expect the Iranians to do more against Israel, but they're not the ones that the Bible credits at really coming on extremely strong to the point that Israel would actually meet its demise. Mm. That actually comes from this other Psalm 83 alliance with the backing of Germany and Europe. But inside that those scriptures, it actually talks about crafty counsel that is taken against Israel. And that implies that there is deceit involved here, that you wouldn't expect it to come from this source, this attack on the nation of Israel. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of what we can see in this alliance forming right now with the Saudis, with other moderate Sunni states. They think they're their friends, and yet when it comes down to it, they're just engaging this as a relationship of convenience against Iran.
Definitely a situation where if you don't have the orientation provided by Bible prophecy, you're just not even going to think of it this way at all. It won't hit your radar screen, and yet it really does provide insight that is crucial in terms of Israel's decision-making and the way that they're handling themselves in this situation. They really ought to heed these scriptures. If somebody wanted more information, the King of the South booklet has a lot of information about that Psalm 83 alliance, and we referenced that Trends article about it that's on thetrumpet.com, Germany and the Arab states coming together in an alliance. Germany allying with Arab nations, but also Jerusalem in Prophecy gives quite a lot of information about just this double cross that Israel is going to experience at the hands of this alliance. Thanks for that, Brent. A story now out of Britain and just how crazy its policies are with respect to radical Islam. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this may take the cake as the most shocking story, at least to me, that I've read this week. But here's a few startling figures. The British government knows of up to 850 Britons who have left the country to fight for the Islamic State. Over 400 of these people have actually returned to Britain. And even though the government knows they've returned to Britain, only 54 have been convicted of crimes. The other 350 so Islamic State fighters that the government knows about in Britain, they are trying to reassimilate into society. With policymakers saying that they don't actually have proof that they committed any war crimes while they were fighting for the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And they think that maybe they were just naive and deserve a second chance. Actually, even one-upping that, this isn't policy yet, but it's a policy recommendation that since they're thinking poverty may have driven some of these people to fight for the Islamic State, instead of charging them with a crime, they think maybe the government should just pay their rent and help them to become less radicalized.
How very charitable of them. So Kieran Underwood actually wrote an article, Britain's Islamic State fighters are returning home without punishment. Maybe just put this in prophetic context for us here.
Well, he does quote a bit from the end from both Hosea 5 and Hosea 7, which talk about the tribe of Ephraim, which our longtime listeners will know is the ancient ancestors of the British people, and just how like Ephraim is a silly dove and Ephraim is broken in judgment. But I actually looked up the verse he quotes in Hosea 7, 8 through 10 in the contemporary English version. I think that version of that translation of the Bible just really explains this with some powerful language where it says, "The people of Israel have mixed with foreigners. They are a thin piece of bread scorched on one side. They don't seem to realize how weak and feeble they are. Their hair has turned gray while foreigners rule. I am the Lord their God, but in all their troubles, their pride keeps them from returning to me."
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. You can go to thetrumpet.com and look at that article from Kieran Underwood. Britain's Islamic State fighters are returning home without punishment. Definitely an example of the kind of policies that are causing a tremendous danger to the former great Britain. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. This past week, President Donald Trump wrapped up a 12-day trip to Asia. He returned home, proclaiming it a tremendous success. But America's Asian allies had a bit of a different view. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, during this trip, President Trump visited Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. And when he came back, he claimed a great American comeback. And he said that he had had great success restoring the U.S.'s standing in the world, and that he had strengthened old alliances and formed new friendships during this trip. And, you know, it really was refreshing to see a U.S. leader not acting like he's embarrassed for the country and ashamed of its free enterprise system. It was nice to see other nations receiving a U.S. leader with respectful receptions rather than slights. But when it comes to America's Asian allies and Mr. Trump's claims about having reaffirmed our alliances with them, it was actually too little too late. And he delivered some mixed messages, really, that would have been unlikely to reassure them. So these nations at this point are unsure about America's staying power, and there's kind of a growing realization in the region that it is Beijing and not Washington that's mainly steering the agenda. So Mr. Trump seemed to offer up kind of an inconsistent vision of what his Asia policy is. First, he spoke about what he called an Indo-Pacific policy, which would be designed to contain China by boosting ties between the U.S., Japan, Australia, and India. But then once he arrived in China, he apparently felt the need to really soften that anti-China part of his plan. They really rolled out the red carpet for him there in Beijing, and that could have influenced the change maybe. But in China, Mr. Trump spoke mostly about the urgent need for the U.S. and China to work together to solve the world's problems. So this would have been difficult to understand, I think, especially for the Japanese leadership, just the perceived change in his tone there. And one other big development that would have been concerning to Japan, Vietnam, and the Philippines was that Mr. Trump softened his calls for China not to colonize the South China Sea. He did emphasize the need for free navigation and open shipping lanes, but he never singled out China until the very last speech of his trip, when he said in very soft terms that he was somewhat concerned about China's activities there. So these nations whose rightful territories are being gobbled up by China would have been very alarmed by this softer approach. But really, as we've spoken about on the Trumpet Hour before, Mr. Trump's hand is kind of forced in a sense with the North Korean issue, because if he wants to keep China on side with that, he has to be willing to kind of turn a blind eye to China's South China Sea behavior there. And this is, it's really all working to fulfill two major prophecies that the trumpet is watching. One of these is the decline of U.S. power, and Leviticus 26, verse 19, and numerous other passages talk about a very precipitous and rapid fall in U.S. power, and you can see that happening in the Asian arena really clearly. And then the other one is the prophecy of the Kings of the East power bloc, which will be a group of Asian nations working together in a massive military conglomerate. And that's recorded in Revelation 16, verse 12, and several other passages. And if any listeners would be interested in better understanding how America's failure to reassure its Asian allies is really speeding up the congealing of this prophesied Kings of the East bloc, then I would encourage them to read Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's article called China is Steering the World Toward War. And if you just go to thetrumpet.com, we'll have that in the show notes for today's episode.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. One final story, this one coming out of Australia. For this, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this Tuesday, Australia announced that it was becoming the latest English-speaking nation to legalize same-sex marriage, quote-unquote. Britain and the United States led the way, Australia held a referendum on this that stretched from September 12th to November 7th. And then finally, just this Tuesday, got around to announcing the results that 13 million people cast ballots and 61% of them voted yes to legalizing same-sex marriages. And we have an article up on the website by Callum Wood entitled Australia Votes Yes to Same-Sex Marriage, which just spends quite a bit of time pointing out that the fact that they voted yes to calling a same-sex union a marriage just shows how that they've redefined the definition of family as it's been historically understood and as it's been defined in the Bible.
Yeah, another resource that people can look at is Redefining Family. It's quite an extensive exposition of this very strong push to redefine this fundamental institution of family and the causes behind it, just how determined and strategic this effort has been. It hasn't just kind of come about spontaneously. It's really been an active effort on multiple fronts. And it also explains why this is so important for us, why it's such a major issue that we really do need to be concerned about. You can find that under the literature tab on thetrumpet.com, and we'll put that link in the show notes as well. We do have time for one more little item. We'll go back to Richard for the latest updates from Germany.
That's right. Breaking news. Germany does not yet have a coalition. Still, Angela Merkel set a deadline for the preliminary coalition talks that expired Friday morning, and they didn't manage to conclude the talks. They are still talking. All the parties have said they're going to still talk even on into the weekend. But the fact that they've missed that deadline has raised a lot of concerns. It's got a lot of people saying, well, maybe talking about fresh elections in Germany, saying, well, maybe they're not even going to be able to agree to preliminary coalition negotiations. We could be going back to the polls. I think it's made it very clear, the fact that they've missed that deadline, that even if they do get a government, it's going to take them a long time to get there, and it's not going to be stable. So we've been writing about this right from the start of the German election. We've got that article in the latest Trumpet print edition with about the German political earthquake on the front cover. Which I'd really urge our listeners to go back and read if you haven't read that. But this, we're starting to see more and more evidence that this really is a dramatic moment in Germany. And if it just keeps going with Germany having no leadership, well, the Bible talks about exactly this scenario as being a major stepping stone to Germany getting a strong leader. Mm-hmm. So still no leadership. Go back and read that article in the Trumpet print for more of the context behind why we're watching this.
All right, we appreciate you sneaking that in there, Richard. That is it for Trumpet Hour today. I'm Joel Hilliker. I'd like to encourage you to visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to all the articles and the literature we discussed on the program today. Let me know what you thought of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of William Lyon Phelps. This is the final test of a gentleman, his respect for those who can be of no possible service to him. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.